Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford. Today I'm very pleased to have on the author of a book that has just come out entitled The Perfect Thing: How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. The author is Stephen Levy, an editor at Newsweek, and I'll give him a better opportunity to introduce himself. But very briefly, he is the senior editor and chief technology correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He's also the author of several books. The book that I'm most fond of, and wow, I got to know his name, is his book Crypto, dealing with a fascinating story of the alliance basically between government, business, and the world of hackers, quote unquote, that very loaded term. We're going to be talking today, however, about his new book regarding the iPod. And having gone through the book and read it, it's a fascinating story of the development of the iPod as well as its impact both on socialization, culture, music, how people interact with each other. It's really a very broad-ranging book. And the title itself is something that we're going to explore a little bit in what Stephen means by the phrase perfect thing. I'm very excited to have him on, not only because of the impact of the iPod on the world of technology and the world of music, but also because KZSU is a station where most of its programming focuses on music. And in fact, I certainly am a somewhat biased interviewer because I, like many other people, own an iPod. In fact, I have a new video iPod, and I've enjoyed not only listening to music on it, but I've filled it up with more and more video, and I was skeptical about how much video I'd really be watching on my iPod. And Stephen talks about that in his book as well, and even talks about some of his very interesting and revealing interactions with Steve Jobs of Apple, as well as Bill Gates from Microsoft, and we'll explore that as well. But what I found is that as far as video goes, I'm actually watching far more video on it than I thought I would. On the other hand, I do share some of the concerns that are raised by individuals in Stephen's book regarding the impact that the iPod has on how people view their world and, in fact, how they interact with each other. And my interest going back into the world of technology initially started with a certain amount of Luddite views regarding what technology would mean and what it would do for us. And, in fact, I was often concerned as I saw the Walkman kick in, which is another development that led up to the world of the iPod that Stephen discusses in his book. But I was very concerned as I saw more and more people kind of mindlessly listening to music, and I'm certainly a music fan, but not really interacting the same way that they did with others. So all of these social impacts are discussed in the book, as well as economic concerns. So it's really a far-ranging book, and we're going to talk first about the logistics of the book itself and some of its interesting characteristics, and then delve deep into technology, the cultural, and in fact the impact on the music world. So as always, I try to pick music that does, in one way or another, fit into the theme of the discussion, and in a very tongue-in-cheek manner, I've chosen as a theme song today, Everybody Loves You Now, the early Billy Joel song. Again, using it in the tongue-in-cheek manner, it does touch on how popular the iPod is, although I don't think I would ascribe some of the more nihilistic or narcissistic elements of the song to others. But when we return from another tongue-in-cheek song, I'll be very pleased to start the conversation with Stephen Levy, author of The Perfect Thing: How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. Perfect Love, the song which kind of starts us on the conversation today. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's dive right into the discussion. And this show is being recorded on October 25th. And I know that you have other events where you're going to be discussing the book. And so we'll jump right in to kind of the overarching question that begins the discussion. The Perfect Thing. It's a very provocative title. And in fact, the cover of your book is designed in an interesting way because you appear to use the front, back, and side view of an iPod. Tell me a little bit about the title and how you came to that, like I said, very provocative way to catch people's attention.
So I guess the question you're asking me is the iPod perfect?
Well, that's what we're getting to, certainly.
Right, yeah. and the answer is no, and yes, sort of. The answer is no in the sense that it's not flawless. The iPod does have some, ways that it could be improved. The battery is sometimes not all you'd want it to be. It might go too soon. There's no on-off switch. Some people like an on-off switch. The way that you buy songs from the iTunes store doesn't interoperate with competing devices, and I'm a little critical of that. But on the other hand, the iPod is perfect in the sense of the perfect storm model. That everything came together: the technology, the internet, the way we listen to music, the beauty of the device, and just this time to lead to the iPod, you know, having a huge impact, especially for such a little guy. And the second thing is that sometimes when you have an iPod, you're doing a shuffle, and just the right song comes up, and the world transforms itself around you. And all you could say is, perfect.
It's definitely an experience, I think, that most people that listen to any kind of portable music device, and again, you do talk about the Walkman being the starting the soundtrack of our lives idea. And I'm curious, with the title itself and the nature of the book, it does open up the possibility of criticism. I'm curious to get your view on it. I think that you do explain very quickly in the book that one could jump to a conclusion saying that I think that this device is perfect in the sense that it has no flaws. And almost immediately in the book, you dispel that notion. But I'm interested, as you went through the book and as you really looked at these different areas, and we're going to discuss some of them shortly, did you find that you felt that the device was more or less perfect than you initially thought when you started doing the research and started doing the writing?
Well, I don't know if it would say more or less perfect. That the explanation I gave probably is where I started on perfect and where I finished on perfect. Uh-huh. And really the perfect thing started off almost as a working title. And as I got deeper into the book, I realized, you know, actually this can be the title because, you know, of the reasons I mentioned. And maybe it is a little provocative in that sense. And maybe some people will say, oh my God, you know, is this an advertisement? As you say, if you read the book, I get to what I mean pretty quickly, which you could agree or disagree with. But what I did get, as to get a deeper understanding of the iPod as I went on, was just how deeply it affected people and how much it wormed its way into our culture. You know, the iPod became a metaphor. We talk about Google being a verb, but the iPod is a metaphor. People talk about the iPod generation. What does that mean? It could mean just young people, because young people use the iPod, but I've seen it used a lot in terms of saying this generation has a short attention span. They want to go from one thing to another. They got their hand on the skip neck button. And then I hear talk about the iPod of the brain. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? That means the center of your brain that you can listen to music, the center of brain where you can remember things, go on to the next thing. I've heard of, and then there's just the generic, the iPod of X. And that means a wild success. I saw a story in the New York Times the other day talking about the iPod of apples, not Apple computer, but mm-hmm. the fruit. And it was just one new strain of apple, which was wildly successful. And, you know, what's a synonym for wild success? And that happens to be iPod.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting parallel, and I think it also touches on another logistical issue with your book, or logistical change, something that you don't see too much. In focusing on the shuffle capability of the iPod, you've also shuffled chapters of the book. And when I read the introduction, I was thinking, well, this is kind of is it something that changes the nature of how you read the book? Is it gimmickry, or is it really what I think you're trying to do here? And I want to get your probe it a little bit more deeply. The idea that just like an iPod, where you can randomly, or the machine will theoretically randomly pick songs, although you point out some of the odd coincidences of how some of those songs may be selected in order, is the ultimate idea here that we're shuffling the things around us, and that this book is a representation of the fact that there is information coming in different ways, and how you consume it from beginning to end impacts your appreciation of it. I want to probe that a little bit, because aside from the logistical issue of how you go about putting together a book with multiple versions, what is your thinking on the need to shuffle the chapters of your book?
Well, what you said. Mm-hmm. I I became enamored of the shuffle function of the iPod very early on in my experience. When I got my first iPod, I just loaded it up with the CDs, and because I wanted to see what it was like to have 1,000 songs in my pocket, like Steve Jobs promised I would. And I found the best way to then use the iPod was to just put it on the shuffle function. At that point, you had to go through about 3 menus to get to the shuffle thing, to be able to shuffle the songs, which basically means just rearrange them. Just like a blackjack dealer shuffles a deck of cards and puts them in a different order, this put your music collection in a different order. And it was a great way to listen to music. It delivered novelty and some mystery and excitement. And then I started to think about shuffling in a larger sense. And it turns out, what you referred to before, I think you get it, that we're shuffling everything these days. The technology of digital, computers and storing things in digital files allows us to mix and match and mash endlessly. Mm-hmm. And when we would go shopping. We would shop just where we physically were. We'd go into a department store or a mall, and that was where we do the shopping. We'd have to get into our car and drive somewhere else to look at something else. Now we go on the internet and we shuffle shopping. One item here in New York City, and next item maybe in France. We shuffle our news. It's not just the newspaper that comes on your doorstep in the morning, but you start with an article in New York Times, and then you go, of course, to Newsweek, mm-hmm. and then off to the Stanford Daily. So shuffle is part of our lives now. The TV schedule shuffled, the radio shuffled, and what I wanted to do was start people thinking about, gee, what does that mean? The answer to what's the reading experience is sort of a mystery to me. I really wanted to see what would happen, but I certainly wanted people to think about these issues there, and I thought, what better way than to shuffle the book? And I want to make clear that every chapter is self-contained. Mm-hmm. I wrote each chapter as an essay with itself a beginning, middle, and end. So besides the first chapter, which is the same in every book, sort of an introduction, you could, then read the book without fearing that you were going to miss something or something came out of sequence.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the book having just come out, I think it was officially out on Monday. Is
correct.
That right? It's way too early to get the reaction, but be curious as you talk about this book to see whether you can sense how people are reacting to it based upon the order in which they read it. The version that I have.
Yeah, what's chapter two? That's how I name the shuffle.
Chapter two is personal in the version that I have, which to me made sense, partially I think because it's a particular interest of mine, the impact, which we'll go to in a moment. But one other question about the order of the book. You indicated that the first and last chapter are in the same order in every version. So it's the middle chapters, if you will.
Right. The last thing is sort of like a coda. It's just a couple pages. So mm-hmm. I think there's 9 chapters. The first one, is stationary, and then the coda ends. So, I wanted to be able to just fix the words you had going out of the door there.
Mm-hmm. And it makes sense because the first chapter is titled Perfect. So you're dealing with that issue up front. Let's turn to what is my second chapter, Personal, because as I mentioned in the introduction, it's an area of particular interest to me. You have an interesting quote on, I normally would go by page number, but that may not mean as much to people who are maybe listening to it with a copy, but in the chapter.
Listen, there's an index in every book, and there's 4 different indexes.
That's gotta be even more work on the end of putting the book together. My family, both of my parents are in publishing, and I'm very familiar with how books are made as well as how books are edited.
Well, if I could just give one funny story here.
Yeah.
When I proposed this to Simon & Schuster, my editor was pretty wary about this. He's a very conservative guy. But the publisher, who's also fortunately a friend of mine, is more of a roll-the-dice kind of guy. And he thought, what a good idea. And we all decided that we would see what the production staff said, see how they regarded it. And they thought this is going to be great because they do the same thing all the time. This is different.
Uh-huh.
And then this summer, my son, who's 16, took a writing course on a university campus. And he was talking to the authors, the writers who teach him, who teach the course, and they were talking about fictional techniques, and they were sort of down on the whole idea of Julio Cortazar giving a different order to read in the novel Hopscotch and things like that. And my son, you know, raises his hand, you know, very excited. Well, my dad has a book coming out, and he's going to shuffle the chapters. Different people will get them in different orders. And the teachers looked at him and just shook their heads and said, no publisher would ever let him do that.
And certainly it's funny because my father is on the manufacturing side of books, and I remember hearing about how you had to get the chapters together into different versions, and I mentioned this to him, and you know, the shock and awe of the fact that, wow, you had to have these different versions, and how are you going to put it together? That's probably a topic for a different type of show on the manufacturing of books. But turning to the issue of the personalization and what you call personal chapter. I'll quote you to you as a way to kind of begin a discussion. But you say in what is page 2 of that chapter, has the iPod destroyed the social fabric? You ask these as questions. Has it transmogrified us into a zombie culture? And really, that's something that I've always thought about. And I'm curious to see, you talk extensively in the book about, and in fact, you use the word Luddite on the following page. You talk extensively about how people use the iPod to, from everything from a way to deflect suitors that might be approaching them to allowing themselves to escape from whatever concerns they might have. I'm curious whether at the end of the day, when you talk to all of these people, how much impact is the iPod and the fact that people are able to contain themselves in their own world while interacting with a whole host of people? How much impact has that really had at the end of the day on destroying, you know, using that phrase, the social fabric as you see it?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, by and large, the places where iPods are ubiquitous are places where normally social discourse is not thriving. Mm-hmm. So where do I see iPods everywhere? I live in New York City, on the subway. I would say that it's very rare that you're in a normally crowded subway car without seeing a dozen people with iPods. Mm-hmm. The gym, majority of people, iPods. I just read recently that I think Nike did a study, and it used to be that 25% of people would exercise the music. Now it's 75%. Hmm. Now, these are places and these are environments where music will do nothing but enhance your surroundings. Mm-hmm. What seems to happen is there are people who simply see other people with iPods, with those earbuds, and they're enjoying themselves. And it's almost a disapproval. I actually compare it a little to recreational drugs, that some people just can't stand other folks, you know, having a good time with them. Now, obviously, iPods, you know, I guess maybe effects on your ear canals aside, don't have those sort of side effects. Mm-hmm. And so we could take that out of discussion. But when I actually talked to the first person who experienced that personal audio cocoon, he specifically related it to drugs. And I think it's kind of interesting that some people just can't stand other folks having fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it raises that issue, which is something that musicologists often talk about, which is music being background to our lives. And there's a real interesting discussion that exists, and it's not just among classicists or fans of opera, but really across the board, that musicians often feel that the music that they've created is meant to be listened to. And in traditional sense of how people used to listen to music, going back a matter of decades at this point, it would be a family event. And you have, you know, the image of the family gathering around the radio, or around the Victrola, or around the cylinder machine going back 100 years, and simply doing nothing but listening to music. I'm curious to get your sense on whether the iPod is exacerbating that kind of issue. In other words, that music is not meant to be enjoyed for in and of itself, but that it's accompanying other parts of what you do.
Well, I guess in theory, I mean, a lot of people use the iPod with speakers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is a different experience in that case. What often happens when you take an iPod and you put it into a speaker, and whether for a party or a wedding, very popular for weddings, actually, mm-hmm. Or just, you know, relaxing with some friends, it sort of becomes an issue, and this gets into the chapter about identity, about, you know, who's the person with the iPod? What does that person put on his or her iPod? Mm-hmm. What can we think about that person, the iPod? Gee, that's kind of interesting. I was at a dinner this past summer, and the iPod, you know, that was providing the music belonged to a guy who was, I guess, the head of a small independent record label, and mm-hmm. also a member of, you know, sort of a semi-well-known, you know, band himself. And it wasn't the music that came out. It was what this music said. Boy, what's he listening to?
Right.
So that's a little different. I think you do have somewhat of a point there. But I think most people use the iPods just in a one-to-one experience. That you and your iPod. And I think I trace that back really to the Walkman, when Sony felt that, people are going to want to share music with this Walkman with other people. All the original Walkmans had two headphone jacks, mm-hmm. and they even had a little hot button that you could communicate with the person you were listening to talk over the music, and a little microphone there. But people didn't want that. People wanted that one-to-one connection with them and their music.
It's on a personal level, my wife has often threatened to destroy my laptop because it's perennially on when I'm home, and I'm listening to music as I do, and like I said, the caveat that I offer is that I do have an iPod, I subscribe to iTunes, but it also is even in one's home, the computer itself, which is different than the iPod to be sure, has that intrusive effect, and so it's an interesting area to discuss. And it's certainly beyond the ken of this book, but the sociological impact of technology is a huge issue, and something I know you've written about in other contexts, and a topic for another day, and it's something I'd like to explore in future shows. But we'll move on to other parts of your book and kind of touch on as many issues as we can. You have a chapter entitled Cool, and cool the word itself is interesting, and I found, and this is the lawyer's anecdata, its lack of empirical evidence, it's just my own sense, cool is a word that seems to be more and more associated with not just the traditional high school mentality, but really is an element of how technologists and people that are marketing technology think about how they're going to create their particular device, the iPod or any other, and also how it's going to be perceived. I want to ask you a broad question about the term itself. Do you find that it's more and more being used by people from Steve Jobs to journalists covering the field? And what does the word mean to you?
Well, I think the word its widest use since I've been following the language. I mean, the word's been around for quite a while, but the word has really gone massive. It isn't really used by any subculture. It's not, the word cool isn't hip. It is not hip. Mm-hmm. It's a word that everyone uses. And the reason why I sort of focus the chapter of the book around coolness is because you mentioned it is such an objective term. On the other hand, the iPod actually gives us an anchor to discuss coolness.
Mm-hmm.
No one doesn't think the iPod is cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's and I even talked to an academic who said, well, it's the coolest thing in the world, and he's measured it. I thought, you know, by looking at the iPod, maybe we could actually get a better sense of what coolness is, because finally we have something. Everyone agrees this is cool. Here's a data point. We're trying to get our fingers around this jello, and all of a sudden we've got a solid spot to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
So I use that as a jumping off point for a discussion of cool, for discussion of what makes the iPod cool. Does the iPod try to be cool? How does Apple manage coolness? What does mm-hmm. Apple think of coolness? And then I finally wound up talking about design, which is really, I guess, probably a key component to why people think the Apple's cool.
In the world of coolness, you describe a situation that only you could describe in showing the first generation iPod to Bill Gates and how he studied it. the most open-ended question I could give. Can you shed a little more light on that experience of bringing this new device, which was greeted somewhat skeptically, even within, as you describe it, within the journalistic and technology world when they saw it? But can you describe for us a little more detail what it was like to show this device to Bill Gates?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. Sometimes you're in a situation where, in order to tell a story, you're just going to drop a name. Actually, one of the reviewers sort of tweaked me for being a name dropper in this, but I have to say it. This really happened. The day the iPod came out, Apple brought one to my office. Not because I'm a nice guy, because I write for Newsweek, and I write about this stuff. So I had one of the first iPods, certainly one of the first iPods in New York City. And that night, there was a dinner because the next day, Microsoft was going to have their launch of Windows XP. So I was invited to a relatively small dinner with Bill Gates and a bunch of other journalists sat at our table there, and I was sitting next to him. And towards the end of the dinner, when most of the other folks had filtered away, we were talking, and I said, "Bill, have you seen this?" And I reached into my jacket, and I pulled out the iPod, which he had heard Apple had released the device like this, but he hadn't seen one. So it was a really fascinating thing to watch. It reminded me of a movie that maybe I saw or maybe I didn't see, where some space alien comes to Earth, and he's trying to grok, to understand all these strange things on Earth. So he sees this thing. Bill picks it up, and it's almost like you can hear a giant sucking sound as the attributes of this thing, you know, come into focus. And he's twiddling it around. He's going from feature to feature, and he's going through the menus, and he's punching this and looking at that. And finally, he looks up, he says, "You know, this is really a great product. And this is only for Macintosh?" Which back then, of course, it was.
Right, right. And I'm curious, because you've covered Apple and you've known Steve Jobs for how long?
Well, over 20 years.
What, as getting to know someone as closely as you clearly have covering him, how did it impact the creation of your book? I mean, you clearly had an enormous amount of access to him personally and based upon the interviews that you cite. But I'm curious how that relationship impact how you put the book together.
Yeah. Well, first I want to make it clear. It's a professional relationship.
Right.
We don't go out for beers or, nibble on veggies together.
Fair enough.
But, we do see each other fairly often because I cover Apple on a regular basis. And I think because we go back, there's a comfort level in his talking to me that he might not have with someone, he just met. So I've been lucky enough in covering the iPod to have a conversation with him virtually every time something new came out, a new next generation iPod, the iTunes Store, the Shuffle, et cetera, et cetera. And, that really helped me a lot. And I think that because we go back, he will often say things, "You'll remember when this," and we're roughly of the same generation. He actually is a couple years younger than I am, but a lot of the same influences and are shared. We both love Bob Dylan and things like that. So sometimes we will get into conversational byways that aren't strictly technology related.
When we return from a short music break, I want to turn to some of the interesting elements of the iPod, including the world of digital rights management that's found in iTunes and certainly has been the subject of a lot of academic discussion as well as discussion just among people that like to listen to music. So we're going to take a short music break, and when we return on Hearsay Culture with Stephen Levy, author of The Perfect Thing, we'll start the discussion really looking at some of those interesting technological elements of the iPod. You're listening to KZSU. You have Pete Townsend decrying the world of popular culture, and the iPod being something that we talk about coolness, can often be perceived different ways when you have the element of popularity and what's cool and what's popular there. I use the tongue-in-cheek version of that song here to end the discussion dealing with coolness and turn to some other interesting issues. But before we return with Stephen Levy, I just want to do what I always do at the bottom of the hour, which is to ask you if you enjoy listening to KZSU, not only to this show, but to other music programming. If you do, there is always a need to donate to KZSU in order to keep its programming on the air. So if you'd like to donate, feel free to email KZSU at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And otherwise, please keep listening. So we're back with Stephen Levy, author of the book, The Perfect Thing. And I want to turn to some of these technological elements, and how the iPod actually gets the music that it runs. So the iTunes Store is something that you discuss in the book, how it developed, and the fact that it's not a web page, but in fact is a standalone program that integrates directly with the iPod. But you talk about some of the history of how it came to be that the big five, as it were, music companies, BMG, EMI, Universal, Sony, etc., actually went along with the iTunes model. And I want to first kind of get your sense of something that I think often perplexes people when it comes to how iTunes and the iPod work, which is the issue of pricing. And there's been the debate raging for the past year or so, certainly, about the 99-cent model. What's your sense of the pricing model in terms of how the iTunes Store operates and whether it really should change from the standpoint of popularizing the downloading and the sharing of music?
Well, I think the 99 cents a song thing was a brilliant move, really. Steve wanted to do was basically say, I'm going to simplify the experience of buying music, period. Not just buying music online, just buying music. And improve it in a way by and what he knew all along, though I think the record companies were a little slow on the uptake on this, was that it's going to be a huge difference between having to choose to buy everything on a CD and just buying maybe the one or two cuts you like the most, the ones you've heard and you want to own. The record companies were just really reluctant in general to go into internet music, but they knew that they had to do something because their customers were leaving. They were going out the door, and they were getting music for free illegally. And when Steve presented to them, and he had a very organized way of doing this, complete plan. He did the whole thing and demonstrated to them how the store would work, what it would cost, how the rights would work. And he laid all this out, and there was some negotiation. But basically, he took each company, the executives, took them up to his boardroom and gave them a show, showed that he cared, and he had some credibility because he was also the head of a movie studio, remember. He was the CEO of Pixar. So he even got right who to approach first, to get the big dominoes down so he'd do the rest. So that's how he did that. Now, in answer to your other question there, my personal feeling is ultimately the best thing for the music companies and musicians and everyone would be even a lower price than 99 cents. I believe if it were 49 cents, you'd sell more music, and you would have a net revenue gain. And I base this on some data that Rhapsody, Real Networks, did a sale a couple of years ago where they actually absorbed the cost themselves. They sold songs for 49 cents instead of 99 cents, and they sold six times as many. So think of it, maybe half the revenue per song, but six times the songs means three times the revenue.
Right. And it does suggest kind of the battle that ensued, or at least that's been going on. It seems to have died down a little bit now, but it was really killing the golden goose. You had a situation, at least in my view, where the entertainment industry was running into serious problems, and here was a model that actually worked. And you point out the sales data on iTunes, even in the first week, where you're talking about a million? Was it a million downloads?
Yes.
Which is obviously an incredible number. Touching on that a little further, is, of course, as we're recording the show now, 4 miles from here is a Tower Records that's going out of business. Tower Records, of course, built on the traditional brick-and-mortar idea of selling CDs. They expanded into DVDs, but it's a music store. They sell some books as well, another medium which people have predicted would demise, but here I am holding a book right now. Do you think that the iPod can affect a change in how the entertainment industry markets itself? In other words, the Tower Records model is something which really, at the end of the day, wouldn't survive unless they decided to sell a different product. And for reasons that are related to finance and not necessarily anything else, the chain's going out of the way. But clearly, CDs are not the popular means of listening to music now. What about the iPod? Where does that take us?
Well, I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface of where we can go with digital music. Clearly, the business to be in the 21st century, is not selling CDs. With the exception of maybe a couple specialty stores along the Amoeba model with an unbelievably huge catalog and a great experience in the store with a band playing and, you know, and guys who, and women who know more than you do, we could talk about, you know, what's there. The action's going to be online with an unlimited catalog, the cuts you want. And as we're seeing, a huge explosion of places devoted to music discovery with all sorts of models, whether analyzing the sonic attributes of a song or from a social networking kind of model. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see all of that stuff come together. And I think the iPod, you know, if Apple's smart, and I think they are clearly, is going to ride on that. Interestingly, Microsoft has pegged that aspect of the future of digital music as what they hope will be a differentiating factor in their contender called Zune, which is coming out this year.
The and that touches on another area that I wanted to discuss briefly, which is the the antecedents to the iPod, but also its competitors. You actually you point out an interesting anecdote, which is that one of the major entertainment companies, the head of Sony, Sir Howard Stringer, pointed out during this discussion that in fact they had missed the boat and were working on a similar device to the iPod with IBM and abandoned it for reasons that you pointed out were based upon how to write the perfect legitimate download, which gets into the area of copyright that I want to talk about. It was interesting to me and to find out through reading your book that there was a debate literally down to the number of how many downloads you could have of a song, how many times you could copy it, and that the numbers really were ranging from 10 at the highest number, it seemed, to 3, which is where we are now in terms of the sharing aspects, if I'm correct, iTunes.
Well, in iTunes, actually, you're 5 computers. You have 5 computers.
Five now. In terms of the,
I've got all 5. Every time I get a new computer in the house, I've got to figure out what to deauthorize and what to send away.
Yeah, which is the challenge of the copywriters, and I'm curious because there's an example of the copyright owners deciding that 5 copies of a particular song is okay when you purchase it once. And I'm curious about your sense of the debate that ensued in terms of the exact number and what would be the appropriate number. Where are we today? Does the fact that the entertainment industry is willing to do this, combined with the fact that the technology allows for this ease of access, mean that we're looking potentially at a situation where the strict enforcement of copyright might be slowly whittled away? In other words, does the iPod allow, because of the economy of scale that they were discussing in terms of the pricing, allow for the possibility that enforcement changes and what the entertainment industry ultimately wants to do with their rights changes as well?
I think the most positive force in terms of helping the record labels deliver, approve of a package of rights, which is, good for the user and makes, buying of music digitally attractive. The most positive force is the existence of illegal file sharing networks. I'm not endorsing them, but I'm saying the fact that they're out there keeps the record labels honest to a certain degree. They can't walk away from it. They can't say these rights have to be too restrictive because people will abandon it. And that was Jobs' argument to them recently. You mentioned they wanted to raise the prices. I did an interview with him in conjunction with an excerpt that ran in Newsweek a couple weeks ago. And I asked him about this. And he said, look, what we told them was if we raise the price now, people will say, wait a minute, this was the deal we struck with you. Forget it. We're not going to do this anymore. We're just going to go back to being pirates. Mm-hmm. And I think that by and large, what has to be done is that we need music systems, rights protection systems that don't seem like they were written by lawyers. Mm-hmm. And that don't seem like they were written by engineers, because that's hard to use, but seem like they were written by fans. Mm-hmm. And the best copy protection system, if we're going to have one, is one where that an honest person isn't even aware that the restrictions exist. Mm-hmm. Right? So to say that you can't make more than 10 burn more than 10 CDs with the same playlist? You know, I could live with that. Why would I need to burn more than 10 CDs of the same CD? Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be backup. I mean, clearly, I'm making them for someone else. My son's making them and selling them in school. I could live with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but right now I say that five computers, that might be... I could use some more, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's only three people in my family,
right? And the 10 seemed like a surprisingly high number, actually, to me. Given again the perception that we have of how these rights are being enforced, the DRM world being one rife with the, at least initially, of the CD that's sold.
Right.
To
I think it's down to seven, incidentally.
And they
knocked it down.
And I was curious, is there what brought that number down? Do you have any insight onto where these numbers are coming from at the end of the day?
Well, you said it yourself. Yeah. You know, 10 seems surprisingly high.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? You're right. You know, at every step, there's the bean counters at the record labels. They just went lower and lower and lower. I tell one story when Jobs was laying out this plan in the boardroom. He would go into whiteboard and he'd write, okay, we want like 10 burns and we want five computers and et cetera, et cetera. And in one of them, one of the bean counter types, one of the lawyers at one of the record labels got up and actually infuriated Steve by wiping that number clean and writing a lower number.
And at the end of the day, it looks like Steve Jobs was able to convince that the number should be where it was, effectively.
Yeah, well, effectively, I'm not sure if he got all he wanted in terms of that, but he got essentially what he wanted was to create a system where you wouldn't feel that there was Big Brother looking over your shoulder as you use the product.
Mm-hmm. The competitors that we've mentioned, and you mentioned Zune, you also talk about Creative in Singapore and other MP3 makers. How effective do you see them being in potentially? I mean, recognizing, of course, that iPod is still dominating the market and iTunes is clearly the league winner when it comes to sales. How effective do you see these competitors in being able to take on the iPod, iTunes monolith that exists today?
I think it's pretty unassailable in this current iteration of technology. But when it comes to, say, music and phones, who knows? That's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone talks about Apple coming out with a phone. That's the big rumor. They haven't shared their plans with me. But mm-hmm. Maybe Nokia could do it better. I don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is there a market to be served by other MP3 players? In other words, when we talk about this device having all of these capabilities, having the shuffle function, having the video, potentially the phone now, is at the end of the day, do we need, do you think, more than one iPod-type device that plays MP3s?
Well, not necessarily, but, different strokes for different folks, right? Mm-hmm. Some people just like having something different than everyone else has.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that gets back to the coolness idea that we were talking about initially.
Right. But it's interesting because iPod, I asked Steve Jobs about this. I said, well, Dick Cheney's got an iPod. How cool can it be, really? And, are you worried that people are going to think, look, my grandmother's got an iPod, and maybe I should get something else? And he had a funny answer. He said, look, you don't want to not kiss someone just because everyone has lips.
That's a good way to put it too. Is the let me in the few minutes that we have left, I kind of want to touch on getting back to what we discussed initially, the shuffle idea, and two quick questions on that to close the discussion today. First of all, in your sense of in the people you've spoken to, how many people are using the shuffle function? In other words, when it comes to the people that you chatted with, I don't know if this came up in your discussions, but the shuffle function is one of many functions that the iPod has. And people could, we talk about the contiguity of an album, the idea that that traditionally the Beatles and others had an album where they purposely chose the order of the songs, whether they were a thematic album or not. I'm curious, do you have a sense of how many people are ultimately shuffling their entire music collection and how many just make a playlist of songs that they particularly want to hear in a certain order? It's anecdata, again, getting back to the lawyer stuff, but I'm curious if you had any insight on that.
Well, it's interesting. I actually, in my asking people, somewhat fewer people than I would expect actually do the shuffle there. I think people have to sometimes stumble across it and discover it on their own. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do it, but a lot of people don't think to do it. And I tell them, look, the next time you take a plane ride, just press that shuffle button. And I mentioned before, when I first used it, you had to go through two menus to find it. And Apple quickly recognized that, gee, this is something that people want to do, and they put shuffle in the top menu, just shuffle songs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when people try it, they're often delighted.
To close the discussion, I just want to, in your coda, you asked the proverbial question that I'll ask here, which is, how do you see us remembering the iPod, this device which was invented about 5 years ago, really, and is now such a major cultural item, not just for people that listen to music, but for people that, like you say, want to be cool?
I think it's the little device that helped walk us into a new era, into an era of digital media, which could be mixed, matched, priced differently, different business model, delivering us different kinds of pleasures and entertainment. And we're going to look back to this period in particular as just the era where the iPod took over. The iPods of the future probably won't look as much as iPods as the ones we have now do. And we'll look back at that. Maybe the way some people look back at the first era of transistor radios or things like that. But this is definitely the age of iPod we're living in.
Stephen, thank you for joining me today and discussing your book, The Perfect Thing, How iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure. Great discussion.
Terrific. That was Stephen Levy, and you're listening to Hearsay Culture. And I want to thank Stephen again for coming here today and actually being in the studio recording. And although he's off to other events discussing his book, I do want to also point out that he's the author of a couple of other books that I would suggest people that are interested in these issues take a look at. The book Crypto, How the Code Rebels Beat the Government, Saving Privacy in the Digital Age is another piece of work that Stephen's done that I think for anyone interested in computer technology and in security issues would be interested in. But when we return from a short music break, appropriate for a discussion of the iPod and of music generally, we will wrap up the show. Freddy Johnston singing This Perfect World. The book was The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness by Stephen Levy, Newsweek editor out of Simon & Schuster. And, you know, the discussion today really kind of gets me to the point where the focus of the show is heavily on technology, but it also increasingly is on music. It's a personal interest of mine. But it's also so much, the music world has been so heavily impacted by technology across the board, both in how it's created, how it's been marketed, how people access it, that it really is a very appropriate crucible to look at technology's impact on the world. Music is something that, as I was discussing with Stephen, is an area that both is studied professionally by musicians who will listen to a song often for the technical capability of the musicians, to people that listen to music casually in the background, to people that have particular interest in not only the music but the lyrics. It has these sociological impacts and sociological roles, as well as being something that people just generally enjoy and oftentimes will build a large part of their life around. I'm an amateur musician. I grew up in a house where music was played a lot, and there's no question in my mind that having grown up in a home that focused heavily on music and our culture impacted how I view the world. So I was pleased to have Stephen on today discussing his book, and I'm looking forward to having other authors on. I'm going to have a run of authors really coming up the next several weeks, just to briefly preview where we're headed. Next week, I'm going to have an interview that I did with Alyssa Hecker, who's an attorney in New York, who actually is on the music licensing side, or was on the music licensing side of the entertainment industry. And we'll have a robust debate about the state of copyright law. And then I'm looking forward to having a number of authors on, ranging from Eric von Hippel, the author of Democratizing Innovation, to Henry Chesbrough, author of Open Innovation. to Paul Duguid from Berkeley, author along with John Seely Brown of The Social Life of Information, and many other people. Also, even going into December, I'm looking forward to interviewing Frank Pasquale, a professor of law at Seton Hall University, who's taking a look at the search engines and how search engines actually put information together. So I continue to have discussions with people that are doing the writing on these issues, as well as people who are actually in the industry. And I'm in the process of arranging for guests going into next year. And I do encourage anyone listening, either by podcast or on KZSU Live, to contact me by email at dlevine@law.stanford.edu. Again, dlevine@law.stanford.edu. And really suggest any guests, as well as offering any comments or criticism, good or bad, positive or minus, regarding how the show is running, because I do welcome that feedback, and I actually do incorporate the thoughts of people that are listening into how I set up the show. It's an ever-ending quest to improve, and I do feel that by getting that feedback, it only helps the show improve, and also allows me to gauge what people are interested in hearing about. So thank you again for listening to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine, a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. You can learn more about the show by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu and checking out my blog. You can also, of course, as I mentioned, if you're not listening to this live on KZSU, you can listen to the show on the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society. You do need to have iTunes. But once you get iTunes, you can then listen to the show by via podcast. And I'm also, as I've mentioned before, working on other ways to actually have the show available to people that don't have iTunes. So that's all coming together, and will be coming together in short order. Thank you for listening today. Stay tuned for Mike as he enters back into the full-time world of music. Thank you for also listening to the show by any means possible. But I do look forward to talking to you next week, and I also look forward to hearing from you as we continue the quest to make Hearsay Culture the most dynamic show that it can be. So thanks for listening today, and enjoy the rest of your day.